Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the September NJEDA Annual Board Meeting. At this time, all phone participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised today's meeting is being recorded. When the chairman opens the public comment portion of the meeting, members of the public attending by phone will be advised to press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad to be placed in queue to speak and provide comment. You will be asked to provide your name and any organization with which you are affiliated. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star and then 0. I would now like to turn the conference over to Chairman Kevin Quinn. Please go ahead.
Tim, if you could read the open public meeting notice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. In accordance with the Open Public Meeting Act, notice of this meeting has been sent to the Star Ledger and the Times of Trenton at least 48 hours prior to this meeting, and the meeting notice has been posted on the Secretary of State's bulletin board at the Department of State. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mayor, let's do a roll call, please.
Okay. Chairman Kevin Quinn.
Present.
Vice Chair Charles Farlow.
Here.
Phil Alagia.
Here.
Virginia Bauer.
Here.
Marcia Marley.
Here.
Robert Shimko.
Here.
Fred Dumont.
Here.
Rosemarie Hicks. Noreen Giblin.
Here.
Labor Commissioner Robert Angelo.
Here.
Elizabeth Dragon for DEP Commissioner Sean Lasserette.
Here.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. We have one set of minutes to approve our July 13th regular meeting minutes. In this hybrid environment, if folks, when they make a motion or a second, please state your name for the record. Can I get a motion to approve the July 13th board meeting minutes?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Second, Angelo.
Thank you, Noreen. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, let's move on to my chairman's remarks. this is pretty exciting. Inc. Magazine recently announced its top five best states to start a business, with New Jersey coming in third. How about that? You know, trailing only California and Texas. That means there were 47 states behind New Jersey, including New York and Massachusetts. That feels great. Keep up the great work here, folks. Inc. in particular recognized New Jersey for its high annual household income, second only to California, and overall ranking of 8 for small businesses with 5 or fewer employees. The EDA programming, obviously, is a real difference maker in helping the small business community here. Today's agenda, I think, demonstrates the breadth of our programming here at the EDA. It includes recommendations for support for early-stage companies, film industry players, entrepreneurs, and small businesses. Hundreds of past participants in the EDA's popular Technology Business Tax Credit Transfer Program can attest to the state's business-friendly environment. The program, commonly known as the Net Operating Loss, or NOL program, is in its 23rd year. It enables the state's early-stage technology and life sciences companies to sell New Jersey net operating losses and unused R&D tax credits to unrelated profitable corporations for cash. Since 1999, more than 575 companies have been awarded benefits totaling more than $1.2 billion. The Economic Recovery Act signed by Governor Murphy in January 2021 increased the annual pool of tax benefits available through the program from $60 million to $75 million. After a lull in applications last year, we received 28 applications this year. Today, EDA staff is recommending 24 applicants for benefits, totaling the full $75 million for 2022. The ERA also established programs to support the recovery and resilience of small businesses across the state through the Main Street Recovery Program. Hundreds of businesses have benefited thus far to the Lease Assistance and Improvement Grant Program, and today the board will be asked to approve final revisions to the next phase, the Main Street Micro Business Loan Program. This program is targeted at micro businesses with less than 10 employees and provides loans up to $50,000 with no interest or payments for 1 year and no collateral needed. In addition to these, three projects will be presented to the board today for approval for support under the Film Tax Credit Program, which was also enhanced by the ERA. Expenses associated with these projects include purchases of goods and services totaling more than $165 million from New Jersey businesses. Under Governor Murphy's leadership, the EDA continues to demonstrate its agility in responding to the evolving needs of businesses. Tim, I turn it over to you for your comments.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for those remarks. I think, you know, any fair assessment of where New Jersey is, where New Jersey's economy is today would have to recognize that we're in better shape than we've been in kind of recent memory. Whether you look at job creation, you look at the credit rating, you look at GDP rankings, you look at inflows of venture capital, you know, we are by no means perfect. We are by no means without challenges, but, you know, the momentum is incredibly strong. And I'm proud of the role that the EDA's programs under Governor Murphy's leadership are playing in that momentum. A few things I'll highlight. It's been 2 months since we had a meeting, so I have a fair bit of history to catch up on, but I'll do so pretty briefly because we have a lot to get through, as the chairman just noted. In July, we marked the first vehicle on the road, the first electric truck on the road under the ZIP program, which we've spoken about at this board a number of times. We had a nice event with the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce up in Bergen County, marking the first vehicle on the road. It's an extraordinary program that's now going statewide thanks to the board's approval earlier this year. HACS, which is an incredibly important initiative up in Newark that we won a national competition to host as a state and the city of Newark, announced where they're going to be located, which is 707 Broad Street. It's an extraordinary space for them, and we're really excited about the opportunity for them to create hundreds of new enterprises, you know, in Newark, in New Jersey over the next several years, with a real focus on engaging deeply with the Newark community, whether it's higher ed, K-12 system, local entrepreneurs, the local manufacturing scene, really making a huge mark, potential huge impact on green manufacturing, onshoring, and hard tech manufacturing. So an extraordinary opportunity there. We also launched the Asset Activation Grant Program in August, and really importantly launched the first pilot round of the Evergreen auction. That auction is open right now. It'll conclude in early October. That's an auction for tax credits under the Evergreen program, which is really designed to supercharge the innovation ecosystem and drive towards Governor Murphy's goal of not just the being the top innovation ecosystem in America, but the most diverse and inclusive innovation ecosystem in America. We'll hear a little bit more about that from Emmanuel in a few minutes when we talk about an investment we're proposing to make in a minority-focused entrepreneurship fund, but really trying to attack that challenge, both the opportunity to regain leadership in innovation and also to do so in a stronger and fairer and more equitable way. Really important. We also had some really good news from a company that was before this board last September, Fiserv. We had sort of hinted at this or described sort of directionally where this was going to head when we first had their approval under the Emerge program. They announced a partnership with Rutgers Newark around inclusive innovation and job training and workforce development for students from the Newark school system and then into the Rutgers Newark system. Rutgers Newark itself, into Fiserv. They're creating a 3,000-job hub in Berkeley Heights, 2,000 of which are new jobs, so lots of hiring opportunities, you know, today and in the future, and partnering with higher ed, particularly with Rutgers Newark, extraordinary opportunity to deepen that connection to New Jersey's higher ed ecosystem. You know, on the topic of sort of diversity and inclusion, we had a busy month in August commemorating Black Business Month. We had a number of events, including a really important roundtable with Black entrepreneurs that Ty Cooper and Christina Fuentes hosted or co-hosted earlier this last month. Starting tomorrow, we begin Hispanic Heritage Month, and so we'll have a series of programs around that. It's worth noting there are more than 120,000 Hispanic-owned businesses, small businesses in New Jersey. That's a number that's grown more than 30% in the last decade. So it's an incredibly important and growing part of our economy. And so thrilled to be, you know, partnering with folks like the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and others throughout the state to celebrate and commemorate Hispanic Heritage Month. And I think launching the microbusiness program, that microbusiness loan program that Christina will talk about in a few minutes, is part and parcel of that. Something like more than 90% of all minority-owned small businesses are some form of micro-business, whether that's a sole proprietorship, an LLC, single-member LLC, or other forms of micro-businesses. So when we're talking about targeting micro-businesses, we're really also talking about targeting Black and Latino, Black and Hispanic-owned businesses in particular. And so a really important demonstration of the governor's commitment to putting resources against our equity and inclusive growth agenda. Last thing I'll mention, at least on the board members' piece, and I'm sure there's available for those of you in the audience as well, we've published that as we think about pushing the message of what we're up to and why it's so important out more broadly and deeply, we put together an activity book meant for kids in the age 5 to 12 around offshore wind. Get a 5-year-old to understand what a nacelle is or how the heck it works, good luck. But at least maybe they can identify the word, circle it in a word search, and understand exactly what the potential impact of this industry and talk about the really pushing out broadly why this is so important from a job creation perspective, from an energy perspective, and an environment perspective. So take a look at that. If you've got a 5 to 12-year-old in your life or a couple, we've got copies for you, and you can make sure they're made available. But we'll be having those at, when we're out doing events and when we're out, at awareness raising opportunities, a great opportunity to kind of get the word out about the economic, this brand new industry, because Kathleen and I were talking this morning, we've got to train the future workforce and getting folks as early as 5, I suppose. I would have said 10, but I
guess. Job application.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I would
reserve your spot.
I would have said 10. I want to be mindful. I don't want to get in trouble with Rob on any child labor situations, but making sure we're getting folks interested at least in a career in the clean energy and offshore wind industry. So. An exciting thing that we're rolling out today as well. So with that, obviously I've covered a lot of ground, but it's been 2 months since we were last together, and there's a heck of a lot going on. So happy to take any questions or yield the floor back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Tim. So the first couple of agenda items fall under the purview of the Policy Committee. One is the annual organizational meeting, which pertains to the election of officers, committee appointments, and the calendar of meetings. The second item is a contract award for auditing and job certification review consulting services. And the last is it's the creation of the New Jersey Offshore Wind Workforce and Skills Development Grant Challenge Program. So let's move to our first item, the annual organizational meeting memo. Danielle Lesser, Director of Governance and Strategic Initiatives, presenting. Danielle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The EDA's bylaws provide that an annual reorganization meeting be held each year in September, and the members are asked to consider the following recommendations associated with the annual reorganization meeting. Charles Sarlo has been serving in the role of vice chairman, and it's recommended that the members approve Charles to continue to serve in the position of vice chairman. Traditionally, the position of board treasurer has been held by the New Jersey State Treasurer, who serves on the board in ex officio capacity. The members are asked to consider that the treasurer remain as the board secretary. And as per the bylaws, Tim Sullivan, in his role as CEO, will serve as the board secretary, and the bylaws also authorize the appointment of assistant secretaries to the board to act in place of the secretary in the secretary's absence, and those names are included in your memo. Per the bylaws, the authority has 5 committees that meet throughout the year, and additionally, in the wake of COVID-19, there's an ad hoc committee that was created. The members are asked to consider maintaining the current chairs of each of those committees and the membership of each of those committees, including Kevin Quinn as chair of the Audit Committee, Marcia Marley as chair of the Director's Loan Review Committee, Charles Sarlo as the chair of the Real Estate Committee, Kevin Quinn as the chair of the Policy Committee, Virginia Bauer as the chair of the Incentives Committee, and Aisha Glover as the chair of the COVID-19 Response Ad Hoc Committee, which will meet as needed. Lastly, the members are asked to affirm the appointment of Marcus Salduti as the authority's records custodian and to appoint a new assistant records custodian, Shamira Alvarez. The members are also requested to reaffirm the appointment of Fred Cole as the ethics liaison officer. Lastly, the members are requested to approve the calendar of board meetings that's attached to your board memo that goes through September of 2023. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Danielle. Any questions for Danielle? We have no questions for Danielle. Can I get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Need a second? Is that Fred? Thank you, Fred. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, next item on the agenda, contract award for auditing and job certification review consulting services. John Rosenfeld, Director of Quality Control, presenting. John.
Chairman.
Sure.
So for the past 5 years, the authority has been party to a contract with Mercadian PC to provide auditing services for completed Grow New Jersey projects. They basically take a deep dive into information for completed projects like invoices, payment support, timesheets, things that we don't necessarily receive. They were selected as through an RFP process. It was a three-year contract with two possible one-year extensions, both of which were exercised. It was originally for them to review 10% of the completed projects for $100,000.
Hey, you know,
In 2019, we received approval from the members to increase the percentage of projects reviewed to 20% for $150,000. So that contract has ended. We went out earlier in the year for with another RFP. We also selected the winner of that RFP was Mercadian PC again. We are looking to do another contract for a three-year term with two possible one-year extensions. Very similar, it's 20% of the completed projects for $150,000 per year. We're also seeking members' approval to delegate the authority for the two extensions to the CEO. And in a nutshell, that's the project. So if anyone has any questions.
Great. Do we have any questions for John? If there's no questions for John, can we get a motion to approve?
So moved.
Thank you, Maureen. Can I get a second?
Second.
Roger.
Thank you, Bill. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, moving to offshore wind, New Jersey Offshore Wind Workforce and Skills Development Grant Challenge Program. Jen Becker, Managing Director of Wind Institute Development, presenting. Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Before you is a request to establish the Offshore Wind Workforce and Skills Development Grant Challenge, a competitive program that will award grants to launch or expand training and skills programs focused on strengthening and diversifying the New Jersey offshore wind workforce. A total of $3,725,000 will be available through this program, with individual awards ranging from $100,000 to $1 million. There's an expectation to make multiple awards for this grant challenge. Funding for this grant challenge comes from the 2021 MOU between the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities and NJEDA to support EDA's efforts to stand up the Wind Institute for Innovation and Training and associated offshore wind programs. The grant challenge will be open to entities that can design and execute workforce and skills training programs. These entities can include, but are not limited to, community-based organizations, workforce training organizations, labor unions, workforce intermediaries, technical high schools, community colleges, universities, nonprofit organizations, private companies. All applications must include at least one community-based organization with demonstrated experience serving a New Jersey overburdened community as defined by the New Jersey Environmental Justice Law. For the purpose of this training challenge, a community-based organization is defined as a 501c3 nonprofit organization that provides direct services or supports to a specific geographic New Jersey community or communities or specific segments of New Jersey communities. For the purpose of this challenge, government entities, K-12 schools, and institutions of higher learning do not qualify as community-based organizations. However, these entities may be the primary applicant or an additional collaborator on the applicant team. Additionally, applicants are encouraged to collaborate with additional entities, including for-profit and nonprofit entities, to design and implement the training program as needed. Applicants must submit proposals that outline compelling plans to develop or expand a program that will allow New Jerseyans to access workforce opportunities in the offshore wind industry by providing tangible skill development and or job readiness training. Proposed initiatives must focus on one or more of the 10 prescribed standard occupation codes that are listed in the board memo. Proposals must also include compelling plans to engage with industry and other stakeholders to design and implement a program that prepares or connects participants with job opportunities in offshore wind, to develop and or utilize outreach, recruitment practices, program design approaches, and wraparound supports as needed, and to execute the project efficiently and on schedule, achieving well-defined milestones to complete the proposed initiative. One of the core objectives for Wind Institute programs is to accelerate the development of a robust and diverse offshore wind workforce. And as mentioned, all applicant teams must include a community-based organization that serves a New Jersey overburdened community with a clear and defined role on the team and one that is proposed to receive a specified funding amount of the requested grant. In addition, the challenges scoring criteria includes up to 25 points for applications that demonstrate an ability to serve an overburdened community, an approach to providing wraparound services, and the ability to offer affordable training to participants. Eligible uses of grant funding include costs associated with planning, soft launch, capital costs, and our implementation costs. All complete applications will be evaluated, scored, and ranked by an evaluation committee comprised of EDA staff based on five primary criteria: program design and the ability of the initiative to meet the need of the offshore wind industry, ability to serve New Jersey's overburdened communities, ability to provide wraparound supports and affordable training, prior experience creating similar programs, and the applicant's team's capacity to implement the proposed initiative, and finally, justification for the proposed use of funds with a reasonable budget to implement the proposed training program. In summary, the members are asked to approve the creation of the Offshore Wind Workforce and Skills Development Grant Challenge, utilizing funds from the MOU between New Jersey Board of Public Utilities and EDA. Thank you.
Do you have any questions for Jen?
I got a couple of questions, Chair. First of all, great program.
Absolutely agree.
And I loved it, the process of applying. Who will be monitoring this process after awards are made?
So it will be run by the EDA at the establishment of the Wind Institute. It's anticipated that the management of the grants would transfer over to the Wind Institute if and once that entity is stood up and created.
Great. I mean,
there's some legislative work between here and there that is not going to happen. So.
I understand. Yeah. Thanks, Tim. If we could get reports on how it's going, I'd appreciate it. I mean, I absolutely love it, including community groups, labor unions, everything. We're going to get a good product out of this, and I appreciate that. And when it's the appropriate time, we'd be happy to move this.
Thank you. I also am full support. I think this is fabulous. How involved is the training? How long is the average training program? And are we able to transition from other dying industries that we might be able to shift this workforce over to?
Yeah, I think that the duration of the training program will certainly vary based on the particular program. So for this particular grant challenge, and we anticipate having other grant challenges in the future, but this particular one is focused on 10 core occupations. And so the focus areas of the programs can vary significantly. So as part of the application, the applicants would have to share sort of the length of time that would be required to complete the program. That's sort of part of the narrative that they would need to include in part of their application. So again, it's hard to say definitively. Some trainings could be
complicated. Is it really
some can be short. I mean, we have the board had approved the Global Wind Organization Basic Safety and Sea Survival Training Facility. That's a really critical training program for the offshore wind industry. That's a module that can be completed in as short as 5 days. Mm-hmm. Other programs could be much longer. So it does vary by focus area.
Isn't it true that a lot of this is specific to wind industry, captains, mates, so on and so forth, but welders, cutters, all that's, there's a shortage of it out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, as listed in the occupation codes, there's a number of, manufacturing and production occupations. So many of these, the types of jobs exist today. We do need to scale them significantly. We need to add in modules that address the specifics of offshore wind, but we have a lot to build upon that that exists here already in the state.
We see a direct benefit going to the middle class in this, and that's important. Thank you.
No, I was just going to say that was my question, too. We can build upon other skill sets that are already out there.
Absolutely. And I'm sorry, I didn't address your question before about transitioning. And so I definitely think there's a lot of transferable skills. There's a lot of related industries that we would definitely be looking to build upon and provide new job and career opportunities for people in the state.
Thank you.
Other questions for Jen? Folks on the phone.
Hi, Jen. It's Rosemary. Hips. Just a quick question. You were just talking about transferable skills. Is the focus going to be on the technical skills or the soft skills? And if it's technical, have we identified in each module, or will we, the amount of time it will take to scale someone to that minimum or acceptable baseline level? And is that going to be part of the requirement for the principal or primary vendors that are selected?
So I think that it's technical skills training as well as sort of the soft skills. I think we're looking for comprehensive programs that prepare people, and understanding that you have to provide different services to different people depending on sort of where they are in their career and where they are, you know, their job readiness level. So the programs are looking to be comprehensive. As I was saying before, I think the specifics in terms of the duration of a particular program will definitely vary by program, and as part of the application process, we'll be requesting that information. We're looking for sort of well-rounded programs that prepare people for the specific opportunities that are presented by offshore wind.
Okay, I have just two more follow-up questions on that. One is, what are the deliverables, and is there a component that will hold accountability for these training programs? Because there's a lot of training programs out there, and we tend to move dollars, not just NJEDA, but in general, put a lot of programs out, and then in terms of deliverable or skill set, is there like a assessment or something that will be happening to ensure that we're getting what we're paying for, number one? And number two, there's a component in the language that speaks to the opportunity for out-of-state primary or principals to bid and be awarded the contract. I know I received something saying that they have to have a presence in the state. But if we're doing Zoom and total online training, is that also a plus or minus in terms of how we evaluate the effectiveness of the proposals? I know that was a little long-winded, but I hope you got the gist of it.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'll try and get to all the questions. If I missed one, please let me know. In terms of sort of the management of the grant and the distribution, so the grant would not be distributed all at once. It's in three phases. So 50% of the grant will be dispersed upon the execution of a grant agreement, which will lay out the specific milestones per the proposal. So, you know, the specific plan outlined in the application that's evaluated. 25% of the grant will be dispersed upon the application submission of the mid-program report, and then 25% dispersed upon the launch of the program or the completion of the grant period that would be outlined in the grant agreement. So the grant agreement sort of govern that structure, and there's additional sort of reporting requirements even after the distribution of the grant, so we can follow up on sort of the metrics of participants starting the program, participants completing the program, jobs connected to jobs and the like. Sorry, I don't have a pen with me, so I didn't get a chance to write down the questions. I think the next question was about location in the state. So all applicants need to submit as part of their application must be registered to do business in New Jersey and be in good standing with EDA's sister agencies. So the community-based organization certainly needs to be a New Jersey-based community-based organization. The applicant, the primary applicant, if it's not the CBO, would need to be registered to do business in the state. We have allowed the opportunity for virtual training programs to be part of the program, recognizing that's, certainly with COVID, that opened up a vast array of training opportunities and actually helps with accessibility for people in some ways. And so virtual training programs operated in New Jersey or other states are eligible under the grant challenge, but the program needs to have a clear approach to connect New Jersey residents. So it has to be, specific to make the training accessible for and targeted to New Jersey residents. So we're not looking to fund a program that's virtual, that has no connection to New Jersey. It's very much tied to the needs of our particular state. I think I got all your questions.
You did. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Jen? If we have no other questions for Jen, can I get a motion to approve?
Motion.
Thank you, Fred. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on to the incentives part of our agenda. Chair of our Incentives Committee, Jenny Bauer, do you have any comments?
I do.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On September 1st, the Incentive Committee met, and a number of items we discussed and hope to approve today, an NOL program to approve applicants for that, film and digital media tax credits. We have three of them to go over and approve, hopefully. The approval of the submission of the Historic Property Reinvestment Program, as well as a modification of New Jersey Growth Program. So that's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. So the first item is the Technology Business Tax Credits Transfer Program 2022 Program Approvals. Chris Shires, Senior Product Officer, Innovation Economy Programs, presenting. Chris.
Hello, happy Wednesday. I'm Christopher Shires, the Senior Product Officer for NOL and ATC, and I'm here to present to you the results of the 2022 NOL program. The NOL program allows technology and biotechnology companies to sell their operating losses and research and tax credits to other corporate entities. The NOL program is an annual program. Applications are due by June 30th every year. The NOL program has been active for over 20 years and has significantly impacted the technology and biotechnology industries in New Jersey. When including the 2022 estimates, the NOL program will have provided more than $1.2 billion in tax benefits to more than 575 companies. Major requirements for this program include companies must have protected proprietary intellectual property. They must employ fewer than 225 employees. They must employ a minimum number of employees in New Jersey. If a company is less than 3 years old, it must have one. If a company is between 3 and 5 years old, it must have 5 employees. And if it's greater than 5 years, it must have 10 employees. The company must have operating losses for the past 2 years. Additionally, the program features include the annual pool of tax benefits to award $75 million. $15 million is set aside for companies located in innovation zones or opportunity zones or being certified with the state of New Jersey as women business enterprises or minority business enterprises. For the 2022 program year, the authority received applications from 28 companies requesting a total benefit of $101,841,129. Program highlights for this year include, of the 28 companies, 5 were new to the program, 8 companies are technology companies, 20 companies are biotechnology companies, 10 applications are from private companies, 18 applications are from publicly traded companies, 2 companies are in an innovation zone, 3 companies are in opportunity zones, 11 companies included DE&I self-disclosed information, evidencing company diversity. This year, 24 applicants are recommended for approval. Staff does not recommend any declinations. 4 companies elected to withdraw their applications. The tax benefit amount requested was $76,174,595, accounting for withdrawn applications and the lifetime cap, which is $20 million per company. Final amounts are determined by the Division of Taxation. Since the program caps the annual pool of tax benefits at $75 million, the allocation of tax benefits will be reapportioned per program rules. The memo contains a complete list of companies recommended for approval with their location and a brief description. I now conclude my prepared remarks and welcome any questions you may have.
Do we have any questions for Christopher?
Hi, this is Rosemary. Are they allowed to stack their losses, meaning that they can sell the tax incentive, but they also receive other tax benefits or benefits from NJEDA as a result of COVID or the pandemic? I mean, do we look at that? Is that something that's part of this review?
So this is Clark Smith, Rosemary. I'm the Director of Innovation Programs. So participating in NOL doesn't preclude you from participating in any other EDA programs. What I would add is that the benefits are not discretionary. So it's directly tied to a company's corporate business tax filings. And if they elect to participate and sell those benefits, they no longer have them. They get transferred to the buyer.
Okay, so they can't come back and ask for a reinstatement. They would have to go back from the beginning and reapply like anyone else for, any other
Correct.
Organization. Okay.
Yeah, once they've sold their benefit, those losses are no longer with their company. They've been transferred to the buying company. Now, if they accrue more losses as they continue with their business, they can come back until they hit the lifetime cap, which is $20 million worth of benefits.
Okay, so let me ask this question, and maybe I've asked it, or maybe you could say it differently or respond differently. So if they're selling their tax incentive, they're selling it to a company. Who gets the money? Who gets the money? The company that sold it, or does those dollars come back to NJEDA?
No, it goes to the company. So basically they're taking their losses and they're able to monetize it for an additional funding source. So
I think what Rosemary's saying is, are they selling their tax incentives that we give them? It's got nothing to do with the incentives. These are operating losses. The business is losing money. Its expenses are greater than its revenues. And those losses, which is an asset to the company, they're selling to a corporate, a third-party corporation that presumably has lots of profitability and wants to shelter their own gains.
Yes,
that's what's going on.
It's transferred over.
Yes, whoever said that, that's what I was asking. Thank you.
Yes. So the buyer then can use it against their tax liability.
Correct. You cannot sell an EDA tax incentive.
Different program.
Oh, yeah. Apples and oranges.
Okay. All right. Rosemary, other questions? Anyone else?
No, that was it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. We have no other questions. Can we get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
And can we get a second?
Second.
Thank you, Fred. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, let's go to the next item on our agenda. Sure. Matt Sestrich, presenting Senior Program Officer, Film and Digital Tax Credit Programs, Certification of Unused or Unredeemed Credits in Fiscal Year 2022 and the Increase to Fiscal Year 2023. This may be a complicated kind of...
We've done it before.
Chairman, before we continue with the next item, I believe Aisha Glover has joined on the phone.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Also, by the way, it's also Liz Moyo. I'm on the phone.
Great. And I want to assure everyone, because this, we've been through this before, this is a very hard thing to follow verbally. When the members of the Incentives Committee, we get charts and written materials, and we can, it's very easy to follow. So don't think that it's not well understood by members of the Incentives Committee and the board. Matt, do your best.
I will try. Again, we've done this before, but the members are asked to approve the certification of unused and unredeemed film and digital media tax credits for state fiscal year 22 and increase the tax credits available with that amount to 23. Additionally, the members will be asked to reallocate unused tax credit allocations from the film lease partner allocation category and bring that over to our legacy film category. As some background, PL 2021 Chapter 367 was enacted back on January 12, 2022, which amended the film and digital media tax credit program. The statute, in part, increased the annual cap available for the digital media tax credit from $10 million to $30 million, beginning back in state fiscal year 2019. Additionally, the statute directs the authority to certify any unused or unredeemed tax credits for each category and carry those forward to the next fiscal year to increase the cap. Additionally, the statute directs the authority to, at its discretion, reallocate tax credits from the film lease partner allocation or the legacy film and transfer between the two as resources are needed. The studio partner allocation and the digital media allocation can also carry forward funds, but those funds need to remain in those respective categories. Back on February 9th of this year, 2022, the board approved the certification and carried forward in unused and unredeemed tax credits for state fiscal year 21. The caps were increased for this year, state fiscal year 20, or last year, state fiscal year 2022, by over $124.4 million for legacy film tax credits, $100 million in both the studio partner and film lease partner allocations, and over $32.4 million for the digital media tax credit. Now, for this carry forward for the legacy film allocation, we started the year with a cap of over $223.4 million in available credits. We had 38 approvals for over $198.7 million. One of those approvals withdrew before they received any credit for a total of $3.5 million, which gives us a total unused unredeemed credit amount for 2022 of $24,612,793. This increases our film tax credit cap for 2023, this year, to over $128.1 million. For the studio partner allocation, there was a cap to start the year with $200 million. We had no approvals under that program, so the total unused or unredeemed amount was $200 million. This increased the cap available for this fiscal year, 2023, to $300 million. Same thing for the film lease partner for 2022. We had a starting allocation of $200 million. There were no approvals under that allocation category, which gives us, we carry forward $200 million to this year, which gives us a total cap of $300 million for this fiscal year. The reallocation part, so as directed by PL 2021, Chapter 367, the authority can reallocate the tax credit caps between the film lease partner and legacy film categories at its discretion, as I mentioned. The legacy film tax credit has seen substantial interest over the last year, and we anticipate that interest and number of submitted applications will only expand. Overall, in fiscal year 2022, we approved 38 projects for just over $198 million. Already, several months into state fiscal year 2023, we have 32 applications submitted for over $130 million. Due to the increased demand and to prevent the program from becoming oversubscribed so early in the fiscal year, staff is recommending the reallocation of $200 million in unused credits from the film lease partner cap to be transferred to the legacy allocation to meet the current demands of the program. There's been minimal interest in the film lease partner program to date, and this reallocation would still maintain $100 million be available for that allocation if we do receive an applicant over the next fiscal year. This reallocation would increase the legacy film tax credit cap to over $378 million. Any unused amounts that remain at the end of this fiscal year, we would be able to carry forward again into next year or reallocate back to the film lease partner allocation to meet the demands at that time. On the digital media side, the state fiscal year 2022 allocation cap to start the year was $62.4 million, and there were two approvals totaling over $7.9 million. Which gives us an unused and unredeemed amount of over $54.5 million, which would increase our cap to start for this fiscal year of over $84.5 million. Staff is recommending the board approve the certification and carry forward of the unused and unredeemed amounts for each of the categories discussed today, as well as the reallocation of the film lease partner allocation into the legacy film tax credit categories. Each carry-forward amount will be used, again, to increase the caps available for this current fiscal year. And this request only requires one vote. Thanks.
There will be a quiz before we can adjourn. Not just right away. You've got to remember for an hour and a half.
So the film and digital media tax credit program is coming out with a workbook like this for middle school math students. We'll walk through allocations, reallocations with, you know, the equalizer, Wu-Tang Clan.
Probably do better than we would.
Do we have any questions for Matt?
Gary, I have a quick question. Matt, so the statute doesn't cap the reallocation?
It used to. The recent amendment in January eliminated that cap.
Yeah, okay.
Other questions for Matt?
So, hi, Matt, Joyce Marie. So if I understand what you just said, that means that this number can go, the carry forward, there's not a cap of the cap, so it could just blossom into any number?
No, there's a fixed amount every year. Anything unused, so that is capped. Yeah. Whatever is unused can roll forward. So the full universe is whatever the cap is times the number of years. It can never be bigger than that. It could be bigger in any given year within that budget.
It allows you to just use unused amounts.
No, there's no way to escape the cap. The cap is hard.
Other questions?
Thank you.
If we have no other questions for Matt, can I get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Second, Elijah.
Thank you, Bill. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, next item.
Chair, Aisha Glover, I don't know if you can hear me, but I think given that audible benefit from the digital media tax credits, I should have been.
Yep, we can hear you. Thanks, Aisha.
Thank you. All right, so we have we're going to have one presentation by Matt around three separate tax credit approvals that all exceed the delegated authority cap of $10 million per project. So, Matt, take it away.
This is a little bit more straightforward, easier to understand, but the EDA staff has completed the review and recommends the approval of three applications under the Film and Digital Media Tax Credit Program. All three applications are under only the film tax side of the program. We received written confirmation from an outside firm hired to review the production budgets to make sure each is reasonable within industry standards. All the film content has been reviewed and recommended for approval under the Act by the New Jersey Motion Picture and Television Commission. Total credits utilized across the three recommended film approvals is over $59.2 million in total credits. The first film application under consideration is for Pacific 2.1 Entertainment Group, Inc., who is responsible for the production of Wu-Tang American Saga Season 3. This project includes a 2% diversity bonus, and we are recommending an award of $25,821,846. The second application is Minim Productions, Inc., who is responsible for the production of Retreat Season 1. This project includes a 2% diversity bonus as well, and we are recommending a total award of $22,692,631. The last application under consideration is Atomic Funk Films, LLC, who is responsible for the production of Insidious 5. For this project, we are recommending an award of $10,766,711. Each project will need its own vote. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Matt? To be clear, I hate scary movies. My wife loves them, my daughter. I digress. Let's. No questions for Matt? All right. Let's. First item: Pacific 2.1 Entertainment Group, Wu-Tang. Tax credit in the amount of almost $23 million. Can I get a motion to approve?
Giblin, so moved.
Thank you, Noreen. Can I get a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? Next item,
Chairman?
Minimum Productions, Inc., tax credit in the amount of $25.7 million. Can I get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Second, Elijah.
Any Phil, any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstention? Atomic Punk Films, LLC, Insidious 5, almost $10.8 million. Can I get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can they second?
I'll second it.
Thank you, Phil. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Got to do them.
All right.
Yeah. Now we're going to rules.
approval of the submission of the Historic Property Reinvestment Program rules to the Office of Administrative Law for adoption. Idita Milstead, Director of Historic Preservation, presenting. Idita.
Good morning. We're here requesting approval of submission of the Historic Property Reinvestment Program rules as final adopted rules for publication in the New Jersey Register. Those rules were originally published for public comment earlier this year through the Office of Administrative Law process in April 4th. One set of comments was received with questions but without request for subsequent changes. Therefore, the staff is recommending that the rules be filed with the OAL for publication as final adopted rules with no amendments. The Historic Property Reinvestment Program and the program rules were presented to the board for approval earlier this year at the February 9th meeting. At the time, we requested approval for the creation of the program, for the submission of the proposed rules for publication and public comment. We also sought authorization to submit the presented rules as final adopted rules if there was no formal comments received. And finally, we asked for delegation of authority to staff to establish an annual application date. Following the board approval, the rules were published for comment on April 4th, and we're open for a 60-day public comment period through June 3rd, in accordance with OIL process. During that time frame, we received comments with one entity, Casper Mortgage Capital, LLC. Their comments included topics such as the sale of the tax credit, recapture of money, monetization of the tax credit, and tax credit process. After reviewing the comments received, NJDA determined that comments submitted would not require amendment to the proposed rules as originally published on April 4th, and therefore we are requesting approval to file the rules as originally presented and published as final adopted rules with no changes.
Great. Any questions for Idita? We have no questions for Idita. Can I get a motion to approve?
Dragon, motion to approve.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Can I get a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, great. Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, just rulemaking is an unsexy but important process. To go through a process like that virtually, you know, without public comment, with lots of public interest, but without meaningful public comment, is a credit to Adita and her team, to Chris and her team, to Gabriel and his team, and really importantly, Commissioner Lazarette and their team, the Lieutenant Governor, her team at DCA, and the team at the Department of State under Secretary of State's leadership, who have been extraordinary partners in crafting what I think is going to be a fantastic historic tax credit program. So,
all right.
Cheers and kudos.
Yeah. So I'll be back in a couple months, with hopefully recommendations for approval. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Next item on the agenda, Adore Me, Inc., Grow New Jersey Assistance Program Modification. Tyshawn Lee, Program Manager, Incentives, Servicing, and Compliance. Tyshawn, please.
Martha, thank you. So this is for Adore Me, Inc., requesting approval to modify the PRO application to reduce the average salary from $50,000 to $30,758. And to affirm that this project has not materially changed to allow staff to complete its certification of project completion. Dormy submitted its certification of completion in June of 2020 with $10.8 million in capital investments, which exceeds the minimum requirement of $2.5 million, and creating 79 of the anticipated 83 new jobs. As a result of the internal QA audit review of this submission, it was identified that the average salary had decreased by 38% from $50,000 at the time of application to $30,000 at project certification. The company explained that when they began occupying the QBF and hiring, there was more of a need for additional floor staff as opposed to directors and managers, as initially anticipated at application, resulting in a reduction in those average salaries. Since this is not a review item nor supported by the regulations to reduce an overall award based on a reduction in average salaries and its effect on the 110% net benefit requirement, staff put the review on hold and was seeking guidance from senior management and the AG's office as to next steps. In the meantime, the company was concerned about how long it was taking us to finalize their review, and after explaining the reasons for the hold, staff recommended that the company could request to modify the average salaries at application, which would result in a reduction of its award from $3.3 million to $2.2 million. The company was amenable to this option and subsequently submitted a modification application, thus allowing staff the ability to move forward with requesting that modification, and if approved by the board today, will allow staff the ability to decision the project certification. Using the modified average salaries, the net benefit was recalculated and resulted in a $279,000 net benefit to the state over 20 years, with a reduced maximum award of $2.2 million, allowing the applicant to continue to meet the required 110% net benefit to the state. The project continues to operate as described at board approval while creating 79 new jobs and expending $10.8 million in capital investment. So again, in summary, we're requesting approval to modify this GROW application to reduce the average salary from $50,000 to $30,758 and to affirm that this project has not materially changed to allow staff to complete the certification of project completion. As a result of this change, the approved award will decrease from $3.3 million to $2.2 million. Thanks for your consideration. I'll be happy to take any questions.
One more bit of context. Great job, Tashawn, as always. If you're scoring at home on the continued engagement and follow-up from the Comptroller's original 2019 report and looking at recommendation 7, which is the reevaluation of that benefit at certification, this is an example first, and we don't know how many more there will be, example of the fruits of that increased review. We always look at jobs, we always look at CapEx, we're now looking at that benefit as well. But really the main way you could ever sort of hit your jobs and hit your CapEx but fall below that benefit is in this scenario we have a significant reduction in average salary. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it'll happen all that often, but if you proposed you were going to build a headquarters and you instead build a lower salary job type of enterprise, this could come up. And so this company's voluntarily agreed to sort of redo their agreement. It's a good example, and I want to thank the Comptroller and Kevin Walsh and his team for their continued partnership with us and making sure we get this as right as we can. So, Tashawn, thank you.
Yeah. Questions for Tashawn? All right, if we have no questions, can I get a motion to approve?
Motion.
Thank you, Fred. Can I get a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, we're going to move to the next portion of our agenda, which is a handful of items under the purview of the Director's Loan Review Committee. Marcia Marley is our chair. Marcia, would you like to say a few words in advance of these agenda items?
Yes, I would, Chairman. The Director's Loan Review Committee met on September 1st when we reviewed and provided input on several items, starting with a limited partnership investment in Innovate Capital Growth Fund, whose investment strategy is to provide growth capital primarily in the form of equity to minority and women-owned lower middle market businesses located in the Mid-Atlantic region. This investment will utilize funding from the Economic Recovery Fund. We also reviewed the creation of an angel match program for early stage investment in tech companies and the creation of a recovery loan loss reserve fund, which will offer a guarantee to community development financial institutions, CDFIs, and minority depository institutions, MDIs, that create a recovery loan program with their own funding. Funding for both of these programs will come from NJ's allocation of the U.S. Treasury State Small Business Credit Initiative, SSBCI, and is subject to the SSBCI funding approval and agreement. The committee also reviewed a modification for the Main Street Recovery Finance Program for microbusiness loans. Chairman Quinn, these requests are now before the entire board for approval and will be explained in more detail by the staff. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marcia. All right, the next item on our agenda is Innovate Capital Growth Fund LP, Emmanuel Esachagi, Diversity Entrepreneurship and Finance Officer. Sorry if I stumbled.
Oh, you did very well.
All right.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman.
Good to see you.
This month, staff is recommending a venture fund commitment to Innovate Capital Growth Fund for an amount up to 2% of committed capital or up to $1 million. ICGF is based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and is targeting a fund size of up to $50 million. It is a licensed SBIC fund that has received significant institutional support to date. The fund will focus on investing growth equity capital in minority and women-owned lower middle market businesses across the Mid-Atlantic region. Their focus is distinctly aligned with the state's objective to create the most diverse, you know, innovative ecosystem in the nation. The fund is sponsored and supported by the Enterprise Center, TEC, which is also a Philadelphia-based community development nonprofit that works to advance economic growth by connecting minority and women-owned companies to contract and development capital. The fund will be managed by three principals, Stella Clark, Blessy Thomas, and Bob Palmer, with more than 70 years of combined experience. They have collectively operated in various investment stages and cycles, ranging from acquisitions to sales of minority investment stakes in middle market businesses. For our analysis, staff reviewed documents and information submitted by Innovate Capital in accordance with the EDA's policies and processes. The EDA's DE&I team has reviewed the firm's submitted DE&I responses as well as the ESG policy to verify the scoring criteria. The authority's commitment to the fund will be accompanied by a side letter agreement that will attest to ICGF's commitment to invest $3 into New Jersey companies for every $1 the authority commits to the fund. The side letter will also require ICGF's commitment to participate in New Jersey's Founders and Funders events, to host monthly office hours in New Jersey, and provide a fund advisory board seat to the NJEDA. We appreciate your consideration to this request for approval of a commitment to Innovate Capital Growth Fund for an amount up to 2% of committed capital or up to $1 million, which we are optimistic will form the basis of a productive relationship to New Jersey's entrepreneurs. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Emmanuel?
Hi, this is Rosemary. Hi, Emmanuel. I have a couple. The first one, you mentioned a couple of times this middle management or middle investor. In
middle market companies?
Yes, middle market. What is a middle market company? And is that called middle market because the focus is going to be in census tract or underserved communities? Or is that just a terminology based on dollars?
No, middle market is based on revenue dollars. I mean, the SBA defines middle market businesses to be businesses that are ranging from $10 million in revenue all the way up to $100 million. But ICGF is focusing on the lower tier of that middle market business, which in effect would be considered a growth fund. They are, in fact, a growth fund, which aligns with what we're trying to do here at the EDA.
And we're doing the dollars because I don't want to call it the parent company, but the partner company, which is the Enterprise Center, is located in New Jersey. And then I guess, I asked this question before, and I did get a response earlier offline, but I'm just having a concern or lack of understanding as to the partnering company being the owner per se, which is of the funding company. It just feels, and they're managing the operations of the funding company, it just feels like they're not operating as separate entities. And I'm just uncomfortable with how that works, and maybe it's just my lack of understanding of this whole venture capital arena or market. But, you know, the Enterprise Center is a nonprofit. They have offices in Philadelphia or PA and New Jersey. The Enterprise Center, two partners of this company, the venture fund, are the CEO and senior leader of the Enterprise Center. The Enterprise Center is handling all the administrative and management responsibilities for the venture fund. And then as we read further, the advisory board is consisting of the folks that are the owners of the for-profit, which is the venture fund. And I guess I'm just not really understanding how that's not a conflict and not understanding how that arms list is being applied here. So if somebody could explain it to me, and if this is an offline conversation, that's fine. But I'm not understanding how this is a separation and one is actually owning the other, and all of the work is being done by the Enterprise Center, which is a nonprofit. I'm just not getting it. It just feels, I don't know.
Manuel, you want to jump in?
Sure. I can offer some context that may be helpful. I will say, first of all, that we could probably not reach this decision today to offer up to $1 million to Innovation Capital Growth Fund without the involvement of the TEC or the Enterprise Center. And this is specifically because TEC is providing a plethora of support that an emerging manager needs to actually function, specifically building the pipeline of investments and performing the early due diligence on those pipeline investments. Board member, every venture capital firm has a multitude of LLCs structured around it, one of which is the management company. The management company is effectively the general partner that will manage the day-to-day functions of the fund. That is what the TEC is providing here. And in addition to coming along with that, they are providing infrastructure services. This includes computers and internet access networks, the physical office spaces where ICGF is operating from. You know, ICGF does not have to go ahead and, provide those services for themselves. From a conflict of interest perspective, the functions are separated entirely. ICGF as a fund will hire, an accounting firm to do its fund work, and it has a fiduciary responsibility to the LPs that have invested in the fund itself. Those LPs are not unimportant. They are highly sophisticated institutional investors, and we've listed some of them in the board memo as well. So putting all that into context, there are two different functions. The TEC's work contributes to the pipeline development of ICGF, helping them find companies to invest in. And the fact that they have gone through TEC's development work and finding contracts further strengthens their strength of revenue or their strength of contracts to make sure that, in fact, they are good investments. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Other questions for Emmanuel?
Chair, quick question. Based on the investment strategy of this fund, is it safe to assume that in the EDA's portfolio, we haven't invested in any other funds with a similar investment strategy?
Yes. I would say so. Not even only just the strategy, but also the composition, being that it's an emerging manager, as well as the manager who 2/3 of their managing partners are minority and women. So this is a good accomplishment, great accomplishment for the EDA.
Other questions?
Okay, let me just circle back really quick then. What other companies have we invested in that has this similar makeup? And I guess the second question is, two of the three partners are TEC executive owners or nonprofit, you can't own a nonprofit, but founder sort of infrastructure. So, again, you know, who else have we done this with that this is not unusual, that has that close of a connection? You said that we've done it before.
Hey, Sam, morning. And Kevin knows more about venture capital than I'll ever – has forgotten more about venture capital than I'll ever know, so I might ask him to tag in here. Generally speaking, so if you look at other funds we've done in the last, you know, couple of years, we, you know, Edison Partners is a management company that owns, looking at Kathleen, 10 funds. We've invested in 6 or 7 of them probably. So it's a pretty standard sort of management company and fund structure. This is, however, the first, as Emmanuel just noted, the first minority and women-owned business targeting, you know, focused investment strategy fund that the EDA, I believe, has ever done, certainly in deep history. It's a pretty standard structure in venture capital. It is the standard structure in venture capital from a sort of management company and fund subsidiary.
All right, thanks.
Great. Any other questions for Emmanuel? If you have no other questions for Emmanuel, can I get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Motion to approve.
Great. Second. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right.
Trust me, I'll abstain.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
Thank you. This item is the Angel Match Program. Kathleen Coviello, Chief Economic Transformation Officer, will provide an overview, and then Monica Afwal, Senior Product Officer, Innovation Programs, will follow up, correct?
Yep,
all
absolutely.
Right, great,
thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Good to be with you all today. You're going to hear colleagues represent investment opportunities or funding opportunities under two programs that are part of a federal initiative, and there will be a continuing cadence of these coming to the next two board meetings. So I wanted to provide a little framework and background for the board on what this federal program is and what it means to the state of New Jersey, and then we'll go into the individual program. So the State Small Business Credit Initiative is a federal program administered by the U.S. Department of Treasury. The program was first established in 2010, and a second round was funded by the American Rescue Plan Act, ARP, in the spring of 2021, with $10 billion of available overall allocation to the states in a non-competitive manner. New Jersey is eligible for $255,197,631. There was a formulaic calculation on how each state was determined on the allocation they would receive. Sub-allocations under New Jersey's $255 million include $15.6 million for socially and economically disadvantaged businesses, known as SETI businesses, and $15.6 million for very small businesses and $27.5 million for very small businesses. U.S. Treasury will administer the program through March of 2028. The SSBCI program is designated to cause and result in the lending and investment of private capital into businesses. So it's a public-private partnership. At the program level, every dollar of federal funds has to be matched by $1 of private capital with a goal and a path to achieving a 10-to-1 leverage ratio of follow-on capital into those companies. Because U.S. Treasury requires a state-level applicant to be able to debar the state and obligate the state, the governor has designated New Jersey Treasury as the lead applicant for the state of New Jersey, with the NJEDA acting as a contracted entity. You might recall the board approved an MOU with U.S. Treasury to implement this program in February of 2022. New Jersey's final application was submitted to U.S. Treasury in earlier in 2011, and we've submitted subsequent minor tweaks to the program. This is New Jersey's second time and EDA's second time administering this program. The prior program was under the Obama administration. We've learned a lot of lessons along the way. The first program was not this magnitude of this current program. If you might recall, when we came to the board earlier on the SSBCI program, we identified six pools of capital and programs that we'll implement under it. The first you'll hear today from Monica is the Angel Match program with a $20 million allocation. The second, which you'll hear from Christina today, is the Recovery Loan Loss Fund at $25 million. You'll be hearing next month from our clean energy team on a clean energy business financing program for $80 million. We will be going to market with a notice of solicitation and availability of funds for venture capital investments, similar to what you heard from Emmanuel. There will be a commitment of $60 million for life science investments, $20 million for a fund specific to socially and economically disadvantaged individuals called the SETI Seed Fund, and $50 million of blended capital for our community development fund. New Jersey's SSBCI application for this round remains under review by U.S. Treasury. We hope to be on their agenda on Friday for final review and commitment. The statute does require that we operationalize all programs within 90 days of signing the allocation agreement with the U.S. Treasury. Upon approval, that allocation agreement will come to us for a DAG review. I think important to note is the goal of diversity, equity, and inclusion within this latest round of SSBCI, which was not factored into the first round. From New Jersey's total $255 million, as I said, $27.5 million has to be focused on SETI businesses as defined by the U.S. SBA. Over time, Treasury may reduce New Jersey's allocation if the state's not on track to meet this minimum threshold. And there is an incentive of available pool of capital if we do well in meeting or exceeding these goals. EDA submission to U.S. Treasury clearly articulated our goals specific to SETI small businesses, and we're confident we will achieve these goals. Funding under this program is dispersed in three different tranches, each a third, and there is a fee associated with each of those thirds to the EDA for administering the program. We cannot draw down on the second and third tranche until we've committed 80% of the previous tranche. The second tranche must be drawn down on or before the three-year anniversary of signing the allocation agreement, and the third tranche must be drawn down before the six-year anniversary of signing the allocation agreement. The administrative fee that the EDA will be able to generate off of these funds is 5% of the first tranche, so 5% of the first third, 3% of the second tranche, and 3% of the third tranche. So a lot of money we have to put to work, and wanted to make sure that the board had that framing for where we're going, as you'll continue to see requests before you for standing up these new initiatives.
Two things to add to that. Great job, as always, Kathleen, and to you and your team for leading the charge, and Christina and Ty's team, Ty and Christina's team on the community development side for the various programs. Two things. One, the rules for the – so this is one. We'll be back a number of times. This is, you know, you see a press release from the 11 federal governments and says, great, there's money coming out, and we all get excited, and then we wake up the next morning and say, oh, crap, we've got to figure out how we're going to program and do it. And so this is there's a series of things that will emanate from that $10 billion allocation coming. Second is there's very specific rules on how this money can be used. It's not the easiest to use money in the world. It's great. We love it. We're thrilled about it. Thank you to the President. Thank you to Congress for doing it. It can't be used for grants. As much as I would love to run big grant programs off this, it cannot be used for grants. It's got to be used for loans or equity. Hence why we've structured the proposals that we've structured. And so this is very, very sort of prescribed federal regulation types of capital, so we can't just do anything we wish with it. As much as I would wish to, that would be fun. But we're constrained by those rules. So Kathleen and her team and Ty and Christina and their teams have done a great job, I think, structuring within that those parameters some really impactful and inclusive growth-oriented programs. So thank you, Kathleen.
And Tim, one thing we might want to just share with the board as well is when the funds recycle back after the end of the program period in 2028, they remain with the authority. We get to keep them. So we saw that in the first first iteration under the Obama administration, those funds are circling back, and it's a good way to capitalize the EDA balance sheet and do more good work.
One last note, Liz and her team at New Jersey Treasury have been great partners in all this. And liaising with U.S. Treasury. So thanks, Liz, for you and your team.
Thanks, Tim.
$250 million worth a little bit of drum roll.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Chairman. Good morning. My name is Monica Afflaw, Senior Product Officer on the Innovation Team. This month I'm here to present Angel Match Program to the board. It is the first of the SSBCI suite of products. Angel investment is a critical source of early stage capital to help startups build and scale. Many businesses will not progress past their initial phases to become successful, high growth job creators without a robust angel investment ecosystem. The proposed Angel Match program addresses these challenges by providing an additional source of funding to businesses at this early stage. It will also stimulate the investment community to provide additional funding. The Angel Match program will utilize approximately $20 million from the New Jersey's SSBCI allocation of approximately $255 million. The program will provide convertible notes to approved companies. The amount of each note will be between $100,000 and $500,000. This amount is determined by matching funds provided by outside investments on a one-to-one basis. The investments must be in the form of preferred equity with a defined price per share. Additionally, the Angel Match note will be unsecured. The note will have a 3% fixed interest rate and a 10-year maturity. There will be no prepayments, there will be no prepayment penalties, and the investments will be defined price per share. There will be no payments for the first 7 years. The NJEDA will receive a warrant with a 10-year maturity. The warrant amount will be 50% of the promissory note. The warrant will stay in place even if the applicant repays the full amount of the note early. To be eligible, the applicant must be an early-stage product-based innovation company within a targeted industry. Other eligibility requirements include physical location in New Jersey, minimum of 50% of employees working in New Jersey, no more than 100 total employees working for the company, two founders or executives working full-time in the state, and minimum revenues of $100,000 within the last 12 months, trailing revenue. Applications for the Angel Match program will be accepted on a rolling basis and processed in order of completeness of the initial application. There will be no pre-application to ensure the applications are processed in a timely manner. Also, the companies will be able to submit information as required throughout the process. Staff requests delegated approval authority for individual company applications, modifications to approved Angel Match notes, and the program changes to comply with SSBCI requirements. In closing, the Angel Match program will have several benefits to the state, including fueling the earliest stage of NJ's innovation economy, creating a pipeline for future venture investment, attracting both early stage companies and angel investors to New Jersey, creating jobs and economic opportunities for New Jerseyans, and catalyzing growth to industries of strategic importance to our state as per Governor Murphy's initiative. The members are requested to approve the creation of the Angel Match program, utilization of the funds from the SSBCI, and delegation of authority to the CEO and his appointing designees. Thank you for your consideration. Any questions?
Monica, I'm curious. You mentioned that there needs to be a fixed price per share, which would presumably exclude any angel investment in safes or convertible notes. Why is there that? Is that from the federal government or is that from our own rules?
That's Clark again. So it's more of an organizational decision. So one, from a risk perspective, preferred equity is a little bit more in a risky asset class. It's the most advanced form of equity structure. And then on the opposite side, internally from an operational perspective, we have in other programs where we'll match a varied array of structures, but it does hamper operational efficiencies. Having it extends the analysis period, and then in closing, we have to maintain multiple different forms of documentation to match each structure. So by going with just one class, it should speed up turnaround times and deployment.
But what it probably does is it probably excludes a significant portion of very early stage companies who all raise money, well, most raise money on a safe or a convertible note. So it kind of, it favors later stage, whether it's a Series C preferred or a, it's not as early stage kind of companies, right? Which are less, presumably less risky. So, okay. Other questions for Monica?
Thank you.
All right. Chair, I actually have a question for Kathleen on her presentation. Did I hear you say 2028? We have to use the whole allocation?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine.
For any tranches we've drawn down, Charles. So if we get to the third tranche, and then there's target dates that we have to draw down each tranche by.
Okay. And then for each of these programs that we're contemplating, want to put in motion, what's the definition of fully positioned?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The U.S. Treasury has not defined that. We have that as an outstanding question to them.
Receive applications? Ready to receive applications?
We have it in writing, on the record, every state is asking. The guidance we've gotten is kind of you have to be able to point to something to say that you're moving forward. There was a challenge in the first round of SSBCI program as states drew down the funds and invested them and sat on them. And so their goal at the federal level, as we understand it, is really to make sure that the money's out into the marketplace. Some folks used it as a way to, you know, build their balance sheet.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. There's no more questions here. Can I get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, let's move to the next item, SSBCI, Recovery Loan Loss Reserve. Christina Fuentes, Managing Director, Small Business Services, Community Development, presenting. Christina.
So this action item is requesting the approval to create a recovery loan loss reserve utilizing $25 million from the State Small Business Credit Initiative, known as SSBCI, once NJEDA receives the approval of their application. Eligible applicants would be community development financial institutions, or CDFIs, and minority depository institutions, known as MDIs. Applicants will apply to receive an allocation of up to $2.5 million to support their own loan product. NJEDA will not be providing direct funding to support the individuals, but rather a 50% guarantee in case the loan may default in the future. Each awardee would be entering into a master guarantee agreement with NJEDA and will incorporate a performance review period that will start 3 years after the closing of their agreement to ensure the allocation is being fully utilized. Loan guarantees are only applicable to a newer existing lending product offered by a CDFI or MDI that offers the following features. It's focused on working capital needs, only for for-profit and nonprofit applicants, offers loans from $10,000 to $250,000. The loan interest rate cannot exceed 12%, and in a loan term of up to 7 years. If a new loan program is created, the minimum credit score must be below 650. Collateral and guarantees will not be required, and the minimum debt service cover ratio can be 1.0. All CDFIs and MDIs that will be approved would be agreeing to the following term. They must provide all additional compliance required by the U.S. Treasury since the program is funded by SSBCI. They would have to comply with quarterly reporting, and they must collect tax clearance certificates for loans that are registered. And the program must be funded with non-federal resources, and they cannot utilize NJEDA funding as that resource. Since the SSBCI funding encourages leveraging partners like CDFIs and MDIs, staff is requesting board approval to create this loan loss reserve program utilizing the $25 million and to request delegated authority on all approvals similar to our COVID loan loss reserve as well.
Thank you, Christina. Any questions for Christina?
Hi, Christina. It's Rosemary. Quick question. You said that the credit score had to be below 650. So
If they were going to create a new program that this guarantee mm-hmm. would support, would make it a requirement that the credit score would have to be below 650.
Okay.
President, any other questions? If we have no other questions, can I get a motion to approve?
I'll make the motion, Chair.
Thank you, Greg. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you, Bill. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? Thank you, Christina.
To advance,
she's right. the next item, staying with us, Main Street Recovery Finance Program Microbusiness Loan Product Revision.
So this action item is to request a revision to the Main Street microbusiness loan product funded through the Main Street Recovery Fund, which is a state appropriation established through the Economic Recovery Act of 2020. Staff is requesting to remove the personal guarantee requirement on this product, and as noted in the board memo, if an applicant defaults on their loan in the future, the applicant would not qualify for the forgiveness that's offered, and the applicant would still need to attempt to cure their default by entering into and complying with a repayment plan to ensure they are in good standing with NJEDA. By not being in good standing, an applicant may not be eligible for other products offered by NJEDA. This action item is also clarifying that since we've received an additional appropriation to support the Main Street Recovery Fund and the products created under the fund, the 3% administrative fee is in addition to the $20 million to support microbusinesses. So there's $20 million holistically to fund support for microbusinesses for this product.
Wow. All right. Any questions for Christina? Questions? No questions for Christina. Can I get a motion to approve?
Dragon, motion to approve.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Can I get a second?
Angelo, second.
Thank you, Rob. Any discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, let's go to the next item on our agenda. Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund, backed by popular demand. David Lawyer, Managing Director Underwriting, who is unfortunately not in the room, but we're going to hear his silky voice, I assume, over the phone.
That is correct. Thank you. Under DEP's Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund Program, we have one municipal application seeking approval. The Township of West Orange has applied for a supplemental grant in the amount of $3.3 million at a property located in their Central Avenue redevelopment area, which is within the township's Central Valley Brownfield development area. The proceeds will be used to fund costs associated with remedial action at a former industrial site. It is the municipality's intent upon completion to redevelop the property for residential and commercial use. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Any questions for David? If you have no questions for David, can I get a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you, Phil. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Moving on to the real estate portion of our agenda. Charles Sarlo is our chair of real estate. Charles, would you like to say a few words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The real estate committee met on September 1st, which happened to be my birthday. I gave it up for all
right,
the committee meetings. So we entertained three matters that were all contract matters related to real estate. The first was a contract extension amendment for Jones Lang LaSalle to continue to provide real estate advisory services to the EDA and the EDA real estate committee until such time a new entity could be selected through the RFP process. The second one was to recommend award a contract to Janco for facility and maintenance services for the EDA's facilities and buildings. And the third is a contract amendment to Langdon Engineering in connection with the remediation of some contamination of a former UST at the Health and Agricultural Building site. Thank you, Chair.
Great. Thank you, Charles. All right, so our first item on the agenda, Fourth Amendment to Real Estate Advisory Consulting Services Contract between Jones Lang LaSalle Americas and the Authority.
George Santos, Chief Real Estate Development Officer, presenting. George, all right.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll be brief. In 2017, by way of background, the authority approved a contract with Jones Lang LaSalle to provide real estate advisory services for a number of years. That contract has had several amendments since then. Most recently, in March of this year, the board approved an extension to help pay for additional work for the Maternal Infant Health Center and for standing up some of the economic recovery programs. Right now, the staff is working on an RFP to, hire a new, staff is working on a contract, an RFP to release to bring on a new firm. We expect that to go out this year and to present the board with a new contract sometime in hopefully the first quarter of next year in order to not lose any time in analyzing applications for the Economic Recovery Act. We're asking the board to approve an extension month to month and up to $500,000 in the contract amount. Those funds will be paid for by the applicants who apply to these programs. Those are not EDA funds. We need authorization, though, to kind of act as a pass-through entity going forward. Are there any questions?
Any questions for George? If there are no questions for George, can I get a motion to approve?
Motion.
Thank you, Brad. Second to Bill. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recuses, abstentions? Thank you, George. Next item, recommendation for award, property and facility management services. Mitch Wardle, Program Manager, Property Management, and Stephen Martirana, Director, Real Estate and Design, presenting.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. The Real Estate Department, with the assistance of IPM Group, issued an RFP for our property and facility management services. We received one proposal, and our committee reviewed it and using the established evaluation criteria. The selection committee selected Velocity Services for this contract. This contract covers property management services at our satellite offices, our headquarters, and any other property that we would undertake managing during the term of the contract. The term of the contract is 3 years with 2 one-year extensions to be exercised at our discretion, and the total expenditures of over the five-year term would be approximately $4.8 million. The contract is scheduled to start November 1st. Based on a complete analysis, we recommend entering into the contract with Velocity Services at this time. Thanks for your time.
Any questions for Mitch? Other questions for Vince? Can I get a motion to approve?
Move it.
Hey, Jenny, can I get a second?
Second.
Phil, any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Moving on to the next item on our agenda, professional services contract budget increase, Langen Engineering and Environmental Services, State Office Building, Health Building Project, Trenton, New Jersey. Diana Bukavich? Did I get that right? Help me out.
Bukavich.
Here we go. Now and forever, Bukavich. Program Manager, Real Estate, Design and Construction, and Steve Martirana, Director, Real Estate and Design.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for all the help, Diana. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Real Estate is requesting the reallocation of board-approved bond funds to increase Langen Engineering and Environmental Services contract by $162,640 for the remediation of two previously unknown underground storage tanks, which we refer to as USTs, found on the Health and Agricultural Demo site here in Trenton. The proposed work for this change order includes environmental consulting services, laboratory services, UST and soil remediation, groundwater remediation, both under the environmental contractor, under the supervision of Langen, and New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection reporting. Thank you for your consideration.
Great. Thanks, Diana. Any questions for Diana? If we have no questions for Diana, can I get a motion to approve?
Motion.
Thank you, Brad. Second?
Second.
All right, Bill. Any discussion? You guys are working well together today. Thank you.
Need your encouragement, Chairman.
But he's buying lunch.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Any recusants? Abstentions?
This is Elizabeth Adragon, abstained due to the DEP permitting oversight.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth. Now we move on to non-voting here. Tim is going to share with us board memorandum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. We've had a robust day already. I know we've got some folks who are here to join us for public comments. I'll be brief. You have in your pack six delegated authority memos covering a wide range of activities. A good reminder that a lot happens at our board meetings. A heck of a lot happens in previous board meetings as well. Some of it higher profile stuff, some of behind the relatively behind the scenes stuff, but you know, significant numbers of levels of activity and things like the annual investor tax credit program, our small business emergency assistance loan program, which is federally funded with another 26 approvals, 13 approvals for our film and digital media program, in addition to the three from about 45 minutes ago, and 79 approvals in our two environmental programs that we partner with DEP on, both PUS and HDSRF. So significant activity, again, in between meetings. Plenty of reporting incorporated therein. Happy to take any questions if anyone has it.
All right, let's move to the public comment portion of the agenda. First, I'd like Danielle Esser to read the NJEDA's public comment policy and process for this telephonic board meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As stated in the NJEDA's public comment policy, members of the public who wish to speak during the public comment portion of the meeting who have registered to speak at the form door will be acknowledged to speak first during the public comment portion of the meeting. Members of the public attending by phone who are interested in providing public comment can press 1 and 0 on their phone to be registered to speak, which will place each person into a queue based on the order received. EDA's public comment policy is posted on the NJEDA website and includes the following. Each speaker will be prompted to speak one at a time. Each speaker should announce his or her name, organization affiliation, and the topic on which the remarks will be given. The speaker will have a maximum of 3 minutes to speak and should limit their matters to comments to matters pertaining to the authority. Staff will prompt the speaker once their time has expired, and the speaker may only speak once during the same public comment period to ensure there's enough time for all those who wish to speak. You can submit any comments in writing as well. We look forward to receiving your public comments at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Danielle. I'd now like to acknowledge any members of the public who have registered. Well, we're not there yet, right? We're going to check on the phone first and then in the room.
We have two in person who have registered.
Okay, so we're going to go with the in person. Our first registered speaker is Aaron Jones, SEIU 32BJ. Speaking.
Do you need the other details first? Pardon me? Organization.
Announce yourself.
Great. Right. So Aaron Jones, I'm the research coordinator with SEIU 32BJ, and I'll be speaking on labor practices at the American Dream Mall. Good morning, Chairman Quinn and members of the board. My name is Aaron Jones, research coordinator at SEIU 32BJ. Thank you for the opportunity to provide public comment here today. Our union represents more than 13,000 building service workers in New Jersey, janitors, security guards, residential workers, food service workers, and airport workers. We strongly support responsible economic development. If done right, projects can create opportunities and jobs for workers throughout our state and at all rungs of the labor market. C2BJ championed the inclusion of building service worker prevailing wage standards in the newly revised EDA programs. We were delighted to see these standards included in the enabling legislation. We look forward to working with the authority to ensure good, family-sustaining building service jobs at all EDA support projects. I'm here today with Jose Turan and Louis Varela, who you'll hear from shortly. Until recently, Jose and Louis worked at cleaners at the American Dream Mall. As you'll be aware, the construction of the mall was aided by the sale of $287 million in bonds that are underpinned by state or grants authorized by the authority. Unfortunately, the American Dream Mall is not an example of responsible development. The financial strife of the mall has been well documented and publicized. The company has defaulted on mortgage payments to its creditors and missed bond payments to holders on a separate set of bonds that are backed by pilot payments to the borough of East Rutherford. In addition to its financial state, the mall is engaged in an irresponsible janitorial contractor called HSA Cleaning. HSA undercuts the industry employment standards and is engaged in unfair labor practices. HSA fired Lewis and Jose after they spoke up for their rights on the job and talked with their colleagues about joining the union. The union has shared the authority ahead of the meeting today, details on the ULP charges that have been filed. HSA is not a signatory to the New Jersey Contractors Agreement, which is the agreement that 32BJ and over 30 janitorial companies are party to, which sets the industry employment standards. Cleaners at the mall have no guarantee of wage increases to keep up with the cost of living in these times of high inflation and have few meaningful benefits, specifically and very importantly, access to affordable health insurance. HSA has no discernible track record of performing work on a scale commensurate with the complexity of a marquee project like the mall. The developer hired HSA in 2020 after it fired the previous janitorial contractor after that company's employees had signed union cards. The grant agreement between the authority and the developer of the mall requires the developer to comply with all applicable laws, which includes federal labor law. The union recognizes that HSA is the direct employer of the cleaners, including the five workers. However, given the authority's interest in ensuring the mall is operated in a responsible and legal manner, and the role of the authority in promoting good jobs on its projects, we believe your attention to this matter is warranted and may help to remedy the situation. We ask that you consider what action is possible under the grant agreement and separately to urge the mall to engage a responsible contractor that is committed to respecting workers' rights and providing workers with the industry standard wages and benefits. Further to this, on behalf of New Jersey's taxpaying working families, we also ask that prior to the release of the grant payments that underpin the bonds, that the authority assess whether the project still stands to deliver the projected net economic benefits to the state that support its initial application. Thank you.
Yes, you're wrapping up. Okay.
Thank you for your time today. The union is happy to provide any information requested by the authority related to this matter, and I also wish to reiterate our appreciation for our cooperative relationship with the authority, and we look forward to working with you on ensuring quality building service jobs and on all EDA projects going forward.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Jose Duran, American Dream Mall.
My name is Yambly Gomez. I'll be translating for Jose.
Okay.
Buenos días, miembro de la Junta de Desarrollo Económico de New Jersey. Mi nombre es José Terán. Vivo en West New York, New Jersey. Hasta hace poco trabajaba haciendo limpieza en el centro comercial conocido como el American Dream Mall. Entiendo que la construcción del centro comercial fue financiada en parte por bonos que están respaldados por pagos de subvenciones aprobados por la Junta de Desarrollo Económico. Estoy aquí hoy porque sé que su objetivo es crear buenos empleos en los proyectos que apoyan. Soy originario de Colombia y me mudé a los Estados Unidos hace 3 años. Durante los 2 últimos años he trabajado en el centro comercial American Dream Mall, 5 días a la semana, de 7 a 3:30. Trabajé haciendo limpieza en todas las instalaciones, incluyendo el parque acuático, el parque Nickelodeon, el patio de comidas. También trabajo medio tiempo en un restaurante en el centro comercial. Como trabajador de limpieza, trabajé para HSA Cleaning, el contratista de limpieza del centro comercial. Trabajamos en condiciones muy difíciles, llenas de intimidaciones y sin acceso a seguros médicos por parte de la empresa, incluso durante la pandemia de COVID. Sin embargo, trabajamos arduamente todos los días para asegurarnos que el centro comercial sea un espacio limpio, seguro y acogedor para todos los que compran y trabajan allí. El domingo 26 de junio recibí un mensaje por WhatsApp avisándome que estaba despedido. Mi colega Luis recibió el mismo mensaje. Esto sucedió porque Luis defendiera a nuestros derechos en una reunión con la gerencia. Y después de que ambos empezáramos a hablar con nuestros colegas sobre la necesidad de un sindicato, solo nos despidieron y no nos dieron ninguna explicación. Mi vida ha cambiado radicalmente desde entonces, aunque seguí en el otro trabajo de medio tiempo, perdí alrededor de $2,000 de ingreso mensual. Mi esposa y yo sobrevivimos con su salario y mis ganancias de medio tiempo. Sin embargo, en el aumento del costo de vida y la inflación y mis responsabilidades financieras aquí y en Colombia no es suficiente. Sé que este despido no fue legal. Sé que nuestro derecho a organizarnos está protegido por la ley laboral. El centro comercial ha firmado un acuerdo con la Autoridad de Desarrollo Económico, comprometiéndose a cumplir con todas las leyes. Hoy estoy aquí para pedirle que el contratista de limpieza que paga el centro comercial no está cumpliendo con la ley. Les pido que por favor tomen medidas para asegurar de que lo hagan. Los limpiadores del centro comercial necesitan desesperadamente salarios que se mantengan a nivel del costo de vida, un seguro médico asequible y el respeto en el trabajo. Sabemos que la única manera de conseguir es organizándonos con el sindicato. Si continúa la intimidación de los trabajadores del centro comercial, la lucha para ganar el sindicato será más difícil y los trabajadores del centro comercial seguirán luchando para mantener a sus familias. Solicito respetuosamente a las autoridades de desarrollo económico de New Jersey que investiguen las prácticas laborales del centro comercial American Dream y sus contratistas y tomen las medidas correspondientes para garantizar y se respeten los derechos de los trabajadores y que solo se utilicen contratistas responsables. Gracias.
Good morning, board members. My name is Jose Terran. I live in West New York, New Jersey, until recently I was a cleaner at the American Dream Mall. I understand that the construction of the mall was partly financed by bonds that are backed by grant payments approved by the EDA. I'm here today because I know that you care about creating good jobs in the projects that you support. I'm originally from Colombia and moved to the U.S. with my family and with my wife 3 years ago. For the past 2 years, I held two jobs, both at the mall. 5 days a week from 7 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. I worked as a cleaner all throughout the facilities, including at the water park, the Nickelodeon park, and the food court. I also worked part-time as a cook at one of the mall's restaurants. As a cleaner, I work for HSA Cleaning, Inc., the mall's janitorial contractor. My coworkers and I work under intimidating conditions and with no company health insurance, including during the COVID pandemic. Nevertheless, we worked hard every day to make sure the mall was a clean, safe, and welcoming space for everyone who shops and works there. On Sunday, June 26, I received a message over WhatsApp letting me know that I was fired. My colleague, Luis, got the same message. This happened after Luis spoke up for our rights at a meeting with management, and after we both started talking to our colleagues about the need for a union. We were given no explanation. My life has changed dramatically since then. Even though I kept my part-time job cooking, I lost about $2,000 of monthly income. My wife and I are surviving on her salary and my part-time earnings. However, with the rising cost of living, inflation, and my financial responsibilities here and in Colombia, it is not enough. I know this firing was not legal. I know that our right to organize is protected under labor law. The mall has signed an agreement with the EDA saying that they will comply with all laws. I'm here to tell you that the cleaning contractor the mall pays is not complying with the law. I ask you to please take action to make sure they do. Cleaners at the mall desperately need wages that keep up with the cost of living. They need affordable health insurance and respect on the job. We know that the only way we are going to get that is by organizing with the union. If the intimidation of workers at the mall continues, it will make the fight to win the union harder, and workers at the mall will continue to struggle to support their families. I respectfully request that the EDA investigate the labor practices of the mall and its contractors, and to take whatever action you can to ensure that workers' rights are being respected and that only responsible contractors are being used. Thank you.
Chair, I have a couple questions, if you don't mind. First of all, thank you for coming forward. We appreciate that. What is the status of your National Labor Relations Board's complaints?
It's been filed. It's received a filing number. We're just going through that process. We have, as part of that application, sort of a 10-J injunction. So hopefully that will come through sooner than the claim itself. I emailed through a summary of the complaint yesterday, so that can be shared around the
future. You emailed that to?
I'll get the public comment address, but I'm happy to follow up with you for the record. So.
Any date assigned to that case?
No, not yet.
Okay. Any conversations between this entity and your labor union?
Not recently. As I said before, had previously been organizing the cleaners under the previous contractor. That contractor was fired. We've been talking to the workers under the new contractor and organizing with them, but yet to formally seek a commission or bargain from HSA.
Are you planning to have a vote to form a union there?
That's definitely an option.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In response, first of all, thank you. I echo Fred's appreciation for, especially you, sir, for being here this morning and telling your story and hearing from you directly. I'm sorry for what's happened to you and your family and your colleagues. Let there be no doubt, this governor, this administration, this authority stands with the rights of workers to organize and to be paid fair wages and for the creation of good jobs. That's why the governor insisted upon, with 30 VA's strong support, included prevailing wage requirements for public service work in the new laws and new programs. This project is under an old program, but it does take to heart the comment about compliance with all applicable laws, and that's certainly an NLRB complaint. I think it'll certainly be relevant here. I don't want to speak for Rob, and I'm sure we'll be following up with him and his team to make sure we understand the particulars of how that all plays out and what our options are as we understand the facts and the determinations from the relevant kind of federal and state authorities here. But we certainly take this incredibly seriously, and again, most importantly, extend our sympathy to you for the hardships you're going through. But we stand with the right to organize, we stand with workers, we stand with unions, and do everything we can under our powers.
Thank you.
And sorry, if I could just follow up with one other sort of response to your question about correspondence with HSA. The nature of the cleaning contract, in all contracted building service work, who is contracting that work really does have a significant amount of control over the economics of that contract. So certainly we are looking to organize the workers that are currently employed by HSA, but we recognize that due to the nature of that contracting environment, they could be fired as well as the employed contractor at the mall, and the owner could bring in another contractor. So what we're really hoping to achieve here is a commitment from the developer itself that whoever is contracted to do this work, that they respect the rights of the workers, and that the mall themselves are committed to be funding that contract to enable to provide the wages and benefits.
Well, I'm just shocked that if you have a contract with them, how can you just terminate that contract because of a union involvement? That seems illegal to me on every level. And I don't know anything about unions, so I'm just asking here.
I hope
that Rob's still on a phone call, because I think Rob would be very interested in this to see if there's violations of overtime, maybe child, a series of events here. So I would encourage you to contact Commissioner Angelo. He does his job extremely well, and I think he'd be very interested in this case, as are we as an entity.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Do we have any other speakers here in the room?
None that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman.
And does that mean now we should check to see if online we have any?
Sunday, can you read the prompt for anybody on the phone who wants to ask a question, please?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, for the members of the public on the phone, if you wish to ask a question, please press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, you may press 1, then 0 at this time. And one moment here. We do not have anybody queuing up for any questions or comments.
All right. Thank you, operator. If there's no additional comments, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation today.
I'd like to make a motion to adjourn.
Chairman Heisler, just real quick, are we going to get a follow-up on this gentleman's concern or status report? Okay.
All right. Didn't get that. Could you try again?
Sorry, that was my laptop talking to me.
All right.
I just wanted to make sure that we would find out.
Thank you, Rosemary. I'd like to thank everyone for their participation. I'd now like to make a motion to adjourn the meeting. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you. Fred, all in favor, aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.